Football Weekly.
Football Weekly, rounding up the wide, wide world of World Cup qualifying. England-Kazakhstan, a 5-1 scoreline that couldn't be more flattering if it was a note from Angelina Jolie saying, "You're the one for me, handsome, come and get it." Scotland-Norway, was Chris Owolumo's shot the biggest miss of all time? What about Michelle McManus? And are George Burley's World Cup hopes over? There's Wales too, the latest on their next opponents, Germany, Ireland, Northern Ireland and beyond. France, what the future holds for starry-eyed Dominic, the word from Spain and their spotless record, and the verdict from Africa. Big teams are already out on the road to 2010. All that and more in coverage that couldn't be more comprehensive if it was a secondary state school that doesn't select on the business of academic achievement. Hello, everybody, then. As you'd expect, it's a crack bunch of global football experts that we've called in today. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul. Phil Honigstein joining us here, Raphael. You're looking well. Fine. Barney Rone.
Hello, James.
Season debut.
It's great to be here.
It is. It's nice to have you on board, sir. And you're English. And England, our first talking point today.
It's a great link.
Yeah? See what I did there? Nice.
Token.
Nice. Now, first the good news. 9 goals in 2 games. Hey? Top of the group, 2 points clear now that Ukraine have drawn 0-0 with Croatia. So, Barney, why the long faces?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of doom being mongered at the moment, despite, on the paper, an impressive start. I mean, it obviously comes back to the first half display against Kazakhstan, which was a little bit disappointing. And Capello getting bogged down in the quicksand of these old problems, like the old Gerrard and Lampard business.
As our colleague Rob Smythe wrote in The Guardian, not since the Gold Blend adverts has a nation invested so much time in a will-they-won't-they couple. Yeah. Well, listen, let's not try and get too bogged down in it ourselves, but do you think... Oh, yeah, Raphael, you do want to. I had two
I'd
questions.
Love to.
Do you think that the one person in the country who's going to continue trying to make this chestnut work is Capello? And if he doesn't, which one's he going to drop?
I don't think he will continue to make
nope.
it work. I think Gerrard's heading for the bench. I think that's the consensus coming out of this game. And also, apparently, people close to Capello have been
is that Gabriele
briefing
Marcotti?
Off the record. No, not Gabriele. No. And the other thing is, of course... I think what we should say is that the formation in the first half was deeply flawed. I think you have to put some blame. I know it becomes sort of a blasphemous these days to say Fabio Capello can do anything wrong, but he got the formation completely wrong, and he didn't help Gerrard and Lampard with that formation, because the 4-3-3 with three central midfielders really did half Kazakhstan's job for them. They compressed the space. They had nowhere to go. Of course, Gerrard likes to go deep for... receiving the first ball, so he was standing next to Barry with only Lampard ahead of them and 5 Kazakhstanis around them. So that didn't work. And I think in a 4-4-2, I'm afraid Gerrard will have to be dropped.
Well, that's interesting. It is also interesting that, unless I'm mistaken, even when England had switched to 4-4-2, the Kazakhstan team continued to have chances and indeed scored a goal. Play like that against Belarus and there could be trouble.
Do you think that he underestimated Kazakhstan as far as he left the left flank vacant, basically, so he could have these three guys in the middle? And a lot of Kazakhstan's attacks came down that left, and they were actually quite handy on the ball. They were more comfortable on the ball, actually, than most of the English players.
I think the opposite was true. I think he overestimated Kazakhstan and went really with a very Italian, very negative and cautious 4-3-3, which...
It's not that cautious.
I don't think it was cautious. You had Rooney and Walcott playing either side of centre-forward. I mean, it's a fairly attacking...
Yeah, but then you had three people just protecting the back four.
Well, I don't think Gerrard and Lampard would generally... I mean, the problem is neither of them wants to play that role. I mean, if we could rely on them to perform defensive duties, it might have been a defensive formation.
No, I think Lampard is very comfortable in that role. That is the role he's been playing for Chelsea the last 5 years. But the Gerrard point is of course, that as Rafa Benitez was saying the other day in a TV interview after these great goals from Gerrard against PSV, he said Steven Gerrard is... one of the best midfielders in the world going forward, which is not really a nice thing to say about a central midfielder, if you think about it. And I think Capello's coming round to that view, and I think he will make that decision soon.
It's fascinating, isn't it? This is a fascinating game in Capello's reign, the Belarus game. This is his chance to actually make a difficult decision, which has eluded several other England managers. Mm. It's a really big call for him. And, you know, this is what we hope, this is what we wanted from him. We wanted him to stand up and make these tough choices. I mean, there's a tradition, isn't there, in Italy of often having... two creative number 10s and one of them has to be left out. We think of Italian managers making those difficult decisions and pragmatic for the team, leaving out these big name players, and maybe we'll get that from Wednesday.
Possibly. It's interesting that you were noticing, Barney, that David James, talking about the formation v Belarus, was saying, we expect to go without a holding midfielder this time around. We're not going to need one. Has he seen Belarus's results?
I don't know if David James has been following them that closely, but certainly this looks like a team that's quite possible to underestimate.
Tell us about their results, Barney.
Well, they've recently they drew with Germany before Euro 2008.
In Germany. 2-2.
Having been 2-0 down.
Mm. Rafa, do you remember
that
game?
Yeah, they did. Vaguely.
All right, okay.
It was one of these pre-tournament games at halftime, I think 11 different Germans came on.
So. Well, how about the Holland game?
Well,
then?
Last year they beat Holland 2-1.
In qualifying, no?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. They played Wales, if this is any kind of indication, 4 times and lost 3 of them. So they're not always on form, but they sometimes are. And they draw their team predominantly from?
Well, from Bate Borisov, who've surprised us all in the Champions League, not just with their peculiar name, but with their 2-2 draw with Juventus.
Yeah, and they didn't do bad in their first game against, was it?
Real Madrid.
Real Madrid, okay, good. There you go. So, you can't underestimate, or you shouldn't underestimate them. Predictions then for Wednesday?
Well, I think that England will drop Gerrard to the bench and win 2-0.
I was going to say exactly the same.
Paul, controversial?
No, I just think England fans will find something to boo about, I'm sure.
Right, okay. Now, you mentioned booing. Probably it'll be Setanta. We effing hate Setanta. Classic moment in I think it was the Andorra game when the host for Setanta said, which was after all the first live England game, Setanta said, "Oh, and the crowd are roaring," and then the director cuts across at the sound goes, "We fucking hate Setanta."
When you're on Setanta, do you have a bit of a go at the pod? Oh, you see me in that podcast.
No, I don't. Always. I don't have a go at that.
I see how it works.
There is an ill feeling among some sections of that, and they believe that people in Sudan, I don't know if I'm, washing dirty clothes in public, that it's predominantly to do with certain lower league teams who have an issue with Setanta over Blue Square coverage have been really, really abusive towards one or two Setanta people.
Well, I think it's a bit 50-50 that Blue Square, isn't it? I mean, some people actually think it's quite good.
I think it's tremendous the job they do for it, as indeed most programmes at Setanta do. Wouldn't you say, Raphael?
Yes, indeed.
I'm doing one tonight.
Oh,
great.
I'll be looking forward to that. Is it not an Irish thing and a England fan thing?
I think
it's a bit of that, isn't it?
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, sorry.
No surrender to Setanta.
That's all the Setanta chat we have time. You mentioned that Ashley Cole controversy. Booing, is it right? Is it right to treat Ashley Cole like a pantomime villain? And the misery not stopping for him. Amel from the Sugar Babes saying on Cheryl's decision to take him back, if it was me, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't even let him look at me. He'd made me feel sick.
Well,
it's not fair, is it?
Well, I don't care about that. Hmm. But, England fans booing him. Do you want my opinion on that, or do you want my opinion
go on
the Sugar Babes?
I
don't
know.
Just the Sugar Babes.
Is that okay?
Babes.
Yeah, I mean, when England fans, I think fans can boo whoever they want to boo.
If they were going to boo anybody.
Yeah, I mean, Ashley Cole, the nature of the mistake, it looked like the mistake of an arrogant man. But in the past, they've chosen their targets less wisely. As Stuart Downing never deserved to be booed, and
David Bentley was a favourite.
Yeah, I mean, but Ashley Cole, if you're going to boo, he's a good choice.
Barney.
Well, can I say that I think the booing and the back pass are both slightly red herrings in the issue of Ashley Cole.
All right.
And I think there's a problem with him as an England fullback. I think he's a very disappointing player. And having anyone who saw his debut would have thought, great, here's an attacking left back. Well, Ashley Cole doesn't score goals, doesn't really create goals. His best performances have been defensive performances. And if you look at the fact that Wes Brown, actually, as a competitive centre-back, looks like a more of an attacking threat than him on the right, it says a lot for his performances. I think he sums up a lot about England, that our best players are just not really that good. And I think Cole's one of them.
Raphael is scowling.
I just think Wes Brown is a threat, full stop.
To who?
I think being a bit harsh on Ashley Cole, I think he perhaps hasn't quite developed the performances that we saw at Euro 2004, where he looked absolutely world class and was England's best player by a mile. Well, perhaps along with Rooney. I agree with that. But I think he's still easily England's best left back. And I think if you'd compile a list of left backs, he'd be in the top 20. Right. I don't think there are that many.
Barney's right, though. He doesn't put in the sort of dangerous crosses that Wes Brown has taken to doing recently.
He is by miles England's left back, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's developed as a player or is doing all that he can.
No, he creates chances, but not for England. That's your
quite.
Well, quite. And Kazakhstan would be very happy with his contribution.
But, you know, I mean, he's going through a sort of lean spell with Chelsea as well, and it's been starting to play much better under Scolari. Maybe we'll see more of that under Capello. I wouldn't jump the gun on this, but the interesting thing with the booing was I was at Wembley, and there was one incident where the crowd were getting, you know, were enjoying the whole booing thing, and they were booing Theo Walcott by mistake for a couple of seconds. And then obviously, you know, word went out, oh no, it's the wrong one, and everybody shut up. But I think Paul is right. I mean, there needs to be some sort of villain for every England game. And if it's not the opposition or the ref, it has to be one of the England players.
I've got my hand up, and it's not because I'm an Italy fan in Sofia. Do they have that kind of issue in Germany? Do you ever get the German fans singling out a player that they hate and giving him shtick?
Not in recent times, no.
Who did?
It happens at club level occasionally, and we'll talk more about this, but Kevin Kurani has been singled out by his own Schalke fans, and of course resigned from the German national team in very controversial circumstances on Saturday, right, well, at half-time.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later on. Because we've got, as I say, a wide world of World Cup qualifiers to cover, but that pretty much sums up England. And on we go to Scotland in a couple of seconds' time. Scotland on Saturday drawing 0-0 at home to Norway in a game that they had said they had to win. Anything less than victory, according to George Burley, would put us in a very difficult position. I think the us is optional. Certainly puts him in a very difficult position. I'm a bit confused about that because they are still second in the group, 4 points from nine. It's not absolutely disastrous. However, I think everything about this game has been overshadowed by the phenomenal miss from Chris Iwolumo. If you didn't see it, seek it out on YouTube. Naismith puts the ball in. Chris Iwolumo's standing near the far post in front of an open goal. Somehow, staggeringly, contrives to side-foot the shot back across the goal and out of play. Fans were already celebrating. I'm told that the linesman was already running back to the halfway point to, you know, in preparation for the restart. And that, I believe, is also Iwolumo's first touch of the ball as an international footballer. It's pretty phenomenal stuff.
Well, yeah, he'll be looking to improve on that probably from now on. That's something to build on.
It's also great, if you watch on YouTube, the reaction by the Scottish commentators is also brilliant because they both think the goal hasn't been given and they're wondering, was it offside? You know, what happened? And then only the, I think, third or fourth repeat, they see that the ball actually never went in. It's great.
Well, there's also a great camera angle that has Iwolumo's own reaction as the ball goes past the post. And you can see his face kind of fall. A kind of philosophical, resigned look come over it. And he sort of turns and runs as though this is the kind of thing that happens all the time.
It's very professional.
Yeah.
Well, amazing. Poor chat. To be fair, I don't think he actually even kicked it. I think it just bounced off his body because he couldn't get his legs in the right order or something.
No, I don't think
he kicked it. Nice side footer.
Yeah?
He made a great connection with the ball. I mean, technically, it was nothing wrong with it.
All right.
In fairness, it is worth saying that he is a good player. And this was his debut, but he should have been in the Scotland squad before now, I think.
For comedy value? Or do you think
No, he is a good player.
It was a little bit reminiscent of that Gomez miss against Austria.
But
Gomez miskicked the ball completely and it was scooped up and over the goal. But this was actually, as Barney and Paul said, a pretty clean hit. And it was just... don't know how he missed it. It's just impossible to miss.
The Gomez miss was extraordinary in the game against Austria. And I was surprised, actually. The Guardian ran a blog on, was this the worst miss of all time, the Iwolumo one, and nobody mentioned Gomez. But one that did get a mention, Pepita Higuain, posted in a link to one by Enrique Vera playing for Libertad de Paraguay in the Libertadores Cup, which I think we've now all seen on YouTube. An astonishing, mainly because, why did this one tickle your fancy, Paul?
Well, mainly because I think he chipped it over the goalie and he decides to follow it in. The ball is bouncing into the net and from 1 yard, he decided to apply an extra flourish and just volley it into the roof of the net, but he hit the crossbar.
And it spun out, much to the confusion.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, there you go. So Scotland, anyway, so much for the Hampden factor. That was their first game there. As I say, there does seem to be this feeling that that's their World Cup chances shot. I mean, they're not going to win the group, which Holland... are favourites to take, but they've still got a chance of making second, though.
Yeah, they certainly do.
Playoff?
They definitely do. Burley does need to look at his approach, I would say, because he did play with only one up front in that match. James McFadden was completely isolated on Saturday. And then when he did introduce Iwilomo, he took McFadden off. Taking Scotland's talisman off at the best of times isn't a good thing to do. But all he was crying out for throughout the match was a bit more support.
Right.
And instead of giving him support, he replaced him.
Well, Chris Boyd has got the chop.
He's chopped himself.
He's chopped himself. Yeah, he's retired from... while George Burley is manager, having only played 28 minutes in the six games of Burley's reign, and Chris Boyd with 7 goals in 15 record for Scotland, so that's quite a loss. How long do you think Burley's going to last at this rate? Barney, you're holding up your hand.
Well, I heard the head of the Scottish FA, Gordon Smith, talking about it this morning, and he seemed to think George Burley's the manager for as far ahead as he can see, and it's not a problem. Although he was strangely supportive of Chris Boyd's decision to retire from international football, which I found a little bit odd, so maybe he's looking to the future
Gordon
as well.
Smith, who's also had his own terrible miss moment, and Smith must score, no?
Well, quite, yeah. So no doubt feeling for the Wolves man at this time.
He was
too.
Up against a goalkeeper. Wasn't that bad a miss?
Right. Well, there you go. So problems ahead for Scotland. Wales... 2-0 victory for them over Liechtenstein. A bit dull. Bellamy, the third Welsh player in a row to miss a penalty. And we could even just talk about their under-21s. You look like a much better side, do they not? They had that narrow 2-3 defeat to England. I don't know if you saw that. They've got another game, the second leg of that playoff, coming off on Tuesday. Private Dick blogging in and saying they...
Well, that's by no means a done deal for England at all.
That's for a place in the European under-21 championships.
That's right, yeah. But no, the Welsh team does look very good. They seem to be producing...
The under-21s.
They seem producing some very good young players.
Yeah. Okay, the senior side, meanwhile, on Wednesday, Raphael, will be taking on your friends and compatriots, Germany, who lead the group four standings with 7 points from 3 matches ahead of second place Wales, who have 6. So they're only 1 point behind.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. Tell us about Germany. Any weaknesses?
That's the wrong question, James.
All right, okay. What's the right
about
question?
Germany, what? Russia.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. Germany, Russia, 2-1. Not entirely convincing victory.
First half was absolutely sensational, phenomenal from Germany. It was the Germany that we wanted to turn up at the Euros but didn't. They were absolutely brilliant, fluid, fantastic. Second half, it was the other way around. Russia really came into it. It was all one-way traffic and Germany just held on. And I think 2-2 would have been a fair result, and Balak even said so. But Russia hit the post very late on. Adler, on his debut in goal, was great. Really, really good. He's probably made that one number one jersey his own after that one game because he was so good. And the fans were singing his name. And it was a massive result because, you know, Russia easily the best team in this group after Germany, or along with Germany. And they've got their one of the worst games or most difficult games out of the way now.
Excellent. But any weaknesses then in the German...
Yeah, I mean, I think the defence in the second half looked a little bit exposed. Per Mertesacker had made one very shocking mistake, which almost led to that goal when Jaschagov hit the post in the 80th minute. But apart from that, they were much better than before, I think is the main thing to say, because they had that balance back. Yeah. They were going forward, certainly in the first half, creating all these wonderful chances, but looking very, very solid at the back. And Arshavin was absolutely nowhere in the first half, and he only came into it in the second half when Germany set back a little bit too deeply.
Tell us about Kevin Kurani.
Well, Kevin Kurani wasn't in the squad. He's only fifth striker right now for Germany because we've got better options. And he'd been told so by Jogi Löw on the eve of the game or at lunchtime. And he was in the stands and he was watching a game, you know, being very unhappy. Then at halftime, he told people that he was going to go and find a friend somewhere in the stadium. But he actually went straight to his car and drove home. Dortmund Schalke is not a big distance. So he went home, switched off his phone. He didn't even pack his bags. He sent some flunkies around to the team hotel to pick up the bags later, who ran then into the German players on Saturday night and, you know, were saying, you know, what are you doing? Oh, we're picking up Kevin Kurani's bags. And, you know, Kurani sort of said, well, I'm not going to play for Germany again. And, of course, Löw said, well, he's not going to be called up again. Mm. There was a phone call in the meantime. He's apologised, but still, as it stands, there's no way back for him. But then it's not great shame because he wouldn't be playing and, you know, he's a bit of a diva and no one needs him right now.
Crikey. Ireland, meanwhile, Paul Doyle. They've got Cyprus next.
They are playing Cyprus
next.
Tasty
outfit, aren't they?
They are. I actually watched their game against Georgia at the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
I'm increasingly worried. They used to, Cyprus at home used to be a gimme, because Cyprus traditionally travel about as well as a concrete bike or something. And but this is Trapattoni's first. This is Trapattoni's first competitive home match, and everyone wants to see if he's going to change the approach from away, where he was very cautious, very compact, and the emphasis was on not.
He's not going to change his approach now.
That's Trapattoni.
Yeah, no, he probably isn't, which means no place for Andy Reid, despite the fact that Stephen Reid, who is our best player in the two games so far, is out injured. Yeah. So he's probably going to replace Andy Reid with Liam Miller, which isn't a particularly inspired choice, and it tells you what he's all about. Basically, he wants compact block with four offensive players, McGeady, Duff, Robbie Keane and Kevin Doyle, and they're there to do all the attacking by themselves. Whether that will work against Cyprus, well, we have to see. But Cyprus aren't like that. They have a very different approach. They're all about speed and attack, and they're actually really good to watch.
Yeah.
With Steve Finnan missing at right back and possibly Paul McShane playing there, that's a definite weakness that could be exploited.
My word, I remember Cyprus against Italy in Italy's opening qualifier. Deserved the win. Italy got it, but were extremely lucky to get 3 points. And Cyprus were very attacking. Right wing, I'm not sure who it was, but giving all sorts of problems to Italian left back. There you go. That's an interesting game on Wednesday then. Now, since we've got you here, how about France-Romania, hey? What happened there? The big thing was about how Dominic was possibly the jig was up for him.
Yeah, he was given, as we know, when they decided to stick with him after the Euros, he was given a target, although it was never made public. But informally, it is known that the target was he was to get at least 5 points from his first nine games. From his first three games, which is quite a modest target. It meant winning their home match and drawing the two away matches. Now, he's failed to get that. He's only got 4 points. And they began the campaign, of course, with a ridiculous 3-1 defeat in Austria.
Who, bizarrely, drew 1-1 this weekend with the Faroe Islands.
Yeah.
That's their first ever point.
Although no one saw it in Austria because the TV equipment hadn't arrived in time. No one saw the game in Austria because the TV equipment hadn't arrived in time. So the guy was doing a radio commentary with just a photo of the match live on Austrian television. I'm not joking.
It's an interesting philosophical question, isn't it? If you draw 1-1 with the Faroe Islands and nobody sees it happen, do you still sacrifice?
They repeated the game next time on Sunday at 4:00, which must have been a great for the ratings. Yeah. Well, I think somebody did film the game, they couldn't send it. They couldn't broadcast it.
My word. Extraordinary. Anyway, so now with Dominic then.
Yeah, well, what happens? Then after the Austrian match, they won 2-1 at home to Serbia. It was a much improved performance. And on Saturday, they went 2-0 down against Romania. Romania shocked them, I think. I think they were expecting the sort of boring approach that Romania produced in the Euros in that famous 0-0 match.
Mm.
And Romania pressed very high up the park, went attacking them. Scored inevitably from a set piece, France conceded, and they went 2-0 up. Dominic, one of the big criticisms about his reign is that when things aren't working, he doesn't know how to change them. He just plods on. But he actually did change this. He took Malouda off in the 38th minute, threw on Karim Benzema, went to 4-4-2. Benzema didn't play particularly well, but the new formation did produce the results, and France were brilliant in the second half. Mm. Had 25 shots and came back to 2-2. Johan Gourcuff, who wasn't at the Euros because he wasn't playing at Milan, basically. Since then, Bordeaux have taken him on loan. He's been excellent for Bordeaux this season. Gourcuff picked him out of the blue, really, against Serbia. He was man of the match in that game. He was brilliant on Saturday, orchestrated matters along with Ribéry. Even in L'Equipe this morning, Vicente Lizarazu is saying that Gourcuff is the new Zidane, that inevitable label that gets
I saw he also won a poll recently as kind of hunkiest player on a female football fans website.
Right.
And what did the Sugar Babes have to say?
I was monitoring these developments, casting my vote.
Right, okay, cool. Nice one.
Yeah, and so interestingly, when France did pull level, all the players ran towards Dominic and made it clear that this was for him. Afterwards, they were all saying that they want to stick with him. He's the man for the job. And Dominic didn't become triumphalist because he's under strict orders just to talk about the match and keep his comments and mood swings and marriage proposals to himself. So it looks like he's going to be kept on. The board are meeting on Wednesday before their friendly against Tunisia.
Mm.
And that they're more than likely going to say you can take them to the World Cup.
Might be a strange time also now, I guess, to change now in the middle of the campaign.
It would, because in fairness to Dominic, he does appear to have learned his lessons. That France are looking different to the team that were at Euro 2008.
Well, Italy, in the meantime, just to finish off this little bit of our roundup, by drawing 0-0 in Sofia against Bulgaria. Giuseppe Rossi coming on the last 25 minutes, and he was about the only impressive thing about Italy, and they think that Rossi's now going to start in their next game, which is against Montenegro Wednesday. The bad news, beyond the fact that they dropped 2 points in that match, was that there were problems with the Italian fans. Not many turned up. Italian fans following Italy never really caused problems before, because it's not a big thing in the same way that, you know, club football is and club allegiances are. But there were swastikas, which I think were held by the Bulgarian fans. But there was certainly, you know, Roman salutes and fascist salutes and chanting and some flag burning from those 144. The Italian authorities say they know who they are. So hopefully that can be stamped out, that kind of thing. Raphael?
Yeah, just a question on the football side of things. I mean, now Lippi's come back, but there hasn't really been any improvement. So what is wrong with Italy?
Lippi's had a massive list of injuries going into this game, but indeed since the start of qualifying. I mean, the Italian national team don't usually qualify particularly impressively. They get the job done, but they don't usually rack up huge wins anywhere. And particularly at the start of qualifying, I mean, we mentioned the game against Cyprus before. Italy in August, September always do badly. They're never prepared physically, their minds are not prepared either, and they just rack up really, really dismal results at that time of year.
I'm told by my Bulgarian contacts that Bulgaria set their target from this match was a draw, and they set out for a 0-0, and Italy said, suits us.
I think
so
Italy would be very happy with that.
Dreadful spectacle.
Yes, there you go. Montenegro could be more interesting on Wednesday, but let's move on from there, and much more still to come, including your post, a bit of Sid Lowe, and the word from Africa. On to part three, then. Much still to discuss. And first of all, it is Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, you just come off the air on some kind of TV show.
Well, I've just been voicing, so I'm not actually on air myself. But I've just been voiceovering some stuff for a television show, yeah.
Really? What have you been voiceovering?
Roundups of the Spanish League for an American audience.
Wow. Do you use phrases like the onion bag?
I'm trying to avoid things like that and things like back of the net. But I've been doing my best to avoid that, yeah.
All right. Do you ever have to commentate on matches that have already taken place and of which you know the result? I've always wondered what mindset commentators
I have had to do that in the past, yeah, and it's quite bizarre. It's quite difficult to resist the temptation to be a colossal smart ass and say, you know, this is the kind of game that's really made for Ronaldo to come on and score a goal. So you do have to try and avoid
that. It's never troubled you before, Sid.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Hey, now, Sid, Spain, 3-0 in Estonia. They won all of their three opening matches. Haven't conceded a goal yet. 2 points clear of Belgium and Turkey in their group. Another clean sheet for Iker Casillas. Now 700 minutes or more since he's conceded. Everything thumbs up. Any problems at all, Sid?
Not really in the way they're playing. I mean, as you say, everybody's talking about Casillas' record, and it's not so much that they've won their three games so far and that they haven't conceded a goal. It's that this goes back so much further. That Casillas has now broken an all-time Spanish record for not conceding goal. In fact, actually, Casillas hasn't quite, because, of course, Casillas shares the record with Pepe Reina, who played one of the games in the European Championships. But Spain have broken their unbeaten, not conceding a goal record. They're looking very, very smooth. There were moments where they slightly turned off, and Vicente del Bosque was slightly critical of that. He said, you know, there are times when we cruise a little bit. But no, in terms of the way they're playing, everything's fine and dandy. I mean, Fernando Torres wasn't brilliant, but they still keep the ball wonderfully. They still use the ball very well, and they just look a step above other teams at the moment. There is, however, a very slight rumbling of a problem within the squad.
Is this the Ballon d'Or business?
This is the Ballon d'Or business. I'm really quite pleased about this. Not pleased that there's a potential rumbling in the squad, but pleased that someone's come out and said something that's been screaming at us for a long time. Fernando Torres came out and he said it's quite clear that there's a campaign for Iker Casillas to win the Ballon d'Or. Now, obviously, that's been read by the press to some extent. It was all problems within the camp. I'm actually not convinced that this is entirely problematic within the camp. I think what Torres was getting at, and he's absolutely right, it's not so much Iker doesn't deserve to win this. What he's saying is, well, hang on a minute, what about me? What about Xavi Hernandez? What about other people who also deserve possibly to win the Ballon d'Or? And I think it's striking. I mean, you know, we could argue all day about who deserves to win it, whether it's Cristiano Ronaldo or Torres or Messi even, which the Catalans are now talking about, which of course is a bit of a joke over what you've done over the last year. But you can argue till you're blue in the face about that. But what is striking, I think this is what's irritated Fernando Torres, is that no one in Spain is talking about him, despite the fact that he scored, of course, the winning goal in the European Championships.
Mm, fair enough, eh? Who do you give it to, Sid?
Personally, I think it depends to what extent you consider the European Championships to have greater weight over.
Who would you give it to?
Yeah. I would give it to Cristiano Ronaldo, but I do feel that the Summer European Championships sort of makes me lean towards Fernando Torres.
All right.
Doesn't it have to be Ronaldo? He scored 42 goals Premier League winning team, and they won the Champions League final, and he scored. I mean, what more do we want from him? I mean, he doesn't.
Well, I think this is what I mean. I think it depends to what extent the international. You know, the international summer outweighs other stuff, and if that's the case, then maybe you could say fell ever so slightly short. But yeah, you can't really argue, I think, with the 42 goals he got for United and the role he played in them winning a double.
Well, that's the thing about the summer tournaments we saw in 2006, when Fabio Cannavaro mystified looks all around, picked up the Ballon d'Or and the World Footballer of the Year in the midst of a dismal season, first season at Real Madrid.
And also, you know, sorry to interrupt, you also saw it when Ronaldo won it. Because he had a brilliant World Cup, scored 8 goals, but he'd done absolutely nothing all year. He'd been injured most of the time, and I think that's where you.
But that was a remarkable. That was a truly remarkable World Cup. Coming back from over a year out, and
exactly.
Many people thought he would never play again.
No, and I think he may deep down have been one of them. And not only that, I mean, he was top scorer at the World Cup. But he got 8 goals, and bear in mind that the top scorer at the previous, I think, 5 or 6 World Cups had never got over 6. Mm. So it was, you know, a really brilliant achievement. But the question mark is, well, hang on a minute, what about the whole year?
Yeah, fair point. Listen, next up for Spain, Belgium, who, you know, reasonable side. What's this, Sid, about England refusing to play a friendly in Madrid? And can you tell us more about that story?
I can only really tell you what I've seen this morning, which is that Adrian Bevington, the direct communications at the English FA, of course, has said that they are talking to Spain about a friendly, that they will play a friendly in Spain, but that they have vetoed the possibility of it being in Madrid. Now, I suppose it depends what they're trying to achieve by doing this. Now, if they're vetoing it because they're genuinely afraid of racial chanting and so on, I think that's almost a little bit of a shame, because it takes away from the Bernabeu and from Spanish fans the opportunity to prove that they're not represented by those who did it last time. If they're trying to do this as almost, if you like, a kind of a punishment, you know, you did it last time, so we're not coming back, and it's the only way fans will learn, then perhaps it's a little bit more understandable. What I don't know for certain at this stage is I think what they're saying is simply that they're vetoing the Bernabeu and that they will play in other Spanish stadiums.
But can I say, I personally don't think that England should play Spain. I think it was totally unacceptable and there wasn't enough sanction. I think, great, don't play them again. Why not? Yeah.
Well, this is what I mean. It depends on how England are going to try and present this. Because obviously, if England are presenting this as a punishment, right? You last time did something really, really unacceptable, and we're not going to accept it, and therefore we're not coming. That's what I mean by kind of, if you like, it makes sense because it's making a point. But if they're saying it's because we're scared of racial chanting, it's sort of slightly different. And
I think if there's ever a country who should give Spain the chance to prove that they've got their house in order, it's England, because for most people, England should never have got Euro 96, given how their fans behaved all the way right up until Euro 96. Even in 95, there was that match abandoned in Dublin because they rioted. In 92, they had caused havoc just after the clubs were allowed back into Europe. But Euro 96 passed off relatively peacefully.
And I think there's another thing here, and I think that's absolutely right. There's also another thing, which is all the way through everything that built up to that last England, and also, of course, the aftermath of that England game at the Bernabeu, there was a sense, and I think an entirely justified sense from the Spanish, that, hang on a minute, how on earth can the English come and lecture us on how to behave as football fans? And I think they felt that we had a bloody cheek, quite honestly. And I think there was obviously some truth in that.
Right. Interesting, Sid. Interesting. Listen, excellent stuff. Of course, you've got a big round of fixtures coming up on the weekend in the Liga, so perhaps we can speak to you on Thursday about that.
Yeah, hope so, yeah.
Thanks very much, Sid.
Cheers, pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I don't really get what happened in the past has got to do with it particularly.
Well,
Just that England have got the benefit of the doubt before, so they should give other teams the benefit of the doubt.
England were also banned from European competition.
Well, that is
the national team weren't.
Mm. Yeah, but you know, what, does that mean it's okay to do racist chanting? That we should be lenient on people?
No, it's in terms of.
I don't think that any makes any difference.
It's in terms of the approach. Hmm. If Spain are saying, no, it won't happen again, we've got it together, which is what
England can't take a stand on things because in the past their fans have
behaved
badly.
Is it England's job to take a stand on things?
Well, it is if they want to, yeah. I think they should have walked off the pitch during the game.
I think they should have. I think Spain should have taken
but
off.
But would you then said, oh, you shouldn't have walked off the pitch because your fans used to be a bit violent?
No, it's in terms of the approach now. We know that there's a racism problem in Spain, just as there was a hooliganism problem with the English national team. England said, no, we're sorted out, and you'll see when you come there won't be a problem. And that's probably what Spain are saying now. So let's see if it's right or not.
And if they go along and if there's a problem, then they leave
then
the pitch.
Then you go, you haven't got it together.
It's not the first time it's happened, is it? There's not an isolated one-off.
No, it's not the first time, but it's a perfect point of comparison to see 2 years later or whatever, same team, same players, do they behave in the same way or not?
Mm, interesting. Also interesting is this report that has surfaced the Football Association receiving match-fixing allegations involving a championship game. This from a Sunday newspaper over the weekend. The bookmakers reportedly detected a massive movement in bets in Asia, surprisingly, in an unspecified championship match and at around half time. Can't really comment further on that yet because we don't know the details, but just to flag that one up. Well, you know the details, Rafa.
Yeah, I can't mention them on air.
Oh, go on. What are the details? Mm. Is it a real story, Rafa?
The story as it reported is real. The problem is you see huge amounts of money swinging in and out of games now as a matter of routine because...
most of it's Sean Ingles, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most bets are now being done in running,
right.
Which is why doing anything against fixed games is becoming more increasingly difficult because it used to be that before a game you saw, oh, there's all this money pouring in on Team A, and you could even, you know, sometimes UEFA sent the referees to have a word with both teams in the change room, etc. But now, these things are being done in running, like 5 minutes after the game start. This particular game, things happen at half time, which in itself, of course, is not enough evidence, really, to say a match was.
Was it a particularly surprising result the way things went after half time?
I can't, because I mean, surely.
Yeah, it must be great to be a ref, Honig, and he knows everything. We're like, tell us, Rafa. And. Lucky chat. Listen, I tell you what, you're obviously in an awkward position there. So let's just move on. Post, plenty of people upset at our money extravaganza the other day. Blue Tyke says that we seriously underestimated the effects of the financial contagion and we cannot begin to imagine what our leagues will look like this time next year. I think I can actually. It's going to be Man U and Chelsea at the top, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I take your point, Blue Tyke. Phil CFC, any chance of a brief Charlton chat this week, this after this talk of a Dubai-based takeover? He says he's not liking the talk at all as a Charlton fan. Liverpool and Newcastle have rejected them, so that shows how much they think of Charlton. He'd rather go down into League One than be bought by Dubai. Footvantage 06 says DAC have only realised, all that's happened is that they've realised that buying a well-run club in London is 100 times better than buying Newcastle or Liverpool. Both clubs with too many past issues to deal with.
I just wanted to say that the first boss got it completely wrong because it wasn't Liverpool, Newcastle refused to buy. It was obviously the other way around.
Quite the other way.
Right, okay. Well, though, actually, wasn't there Hicks and Gillette refused to talk to them? Or
Hicks refused
to talk to them?
No.
Okay,
it's
there you
it's
go.
All about the price. The price was
all about
wrong,
the price. Well, there you go. So, well-run London club, even in a lower division, as has been the case with QPR.
Charlton have a really big catchment area as well. I mean, potentially, there's a lot of people down there who will go and watch them.
Indeed so. To finish off then today, shall we just briefly touch on Africa, where things have been happening this weekend? We had the end of the first stage of group matches, which effectively determined which 20 teams from Africa go through to the second stage. Already some big nations are out of the picture. Paul Doyle.
Yes, they are. The biggest casualty is probably Senegal, who still with half the team that played against Gambia at home on Saturday played in the 2002 World Cup when they were, of course, the sensation of the tournament. They proved on Saturday that they're past it. That's the likes of, well, at least at international level, that's the likes of Salif Diaw, El Hadji Diouf. Halilou Fadiga made his comeback after 3 years out, and they only drew 1-1 at home to Gambia. Now, there couldn't be a worse opponent to put Senegal out. If you look at a map, you'll see why in Senegal people joke and say Gambia is a suppository in our ass. You'll understand that. But Gambia outplayed them at home, 1-1. Gambia have never achieved anything. They nearly qualified. As a result of their draw on Saturday, they miss out on goal difference from qualifying for the African Nations Cup for the first time. But they have unlike Senegal, who have all these old players with big reputations who don't really perform, Gambia have a very young team. Most of the team, or a lot of the team, were part of the under-17 team that were African champions in 2005. They've put this Belgian joker in charge, a guy, Paul Putt is his name, a guy who can't work in Belgium because he's previously been found guilty of match-fixing. And Gambia took him on for an unjustifiable reason, in my opinion.
What was the unjustifiable reason?
Well, because he's European, presumably. Oh, right. They won the under-17 tournament, I'm talking about, with an African in charge, and then they just decided to get a European guy. So they went for a European who can't get a job in Europe. But, in fairness, he did get a good result on Saturday. However, that was with good players who, as I say, outplayed Senegal. As a result, Senegalese fans rioted, and that's been making headlines over here. And it should be said that tensions have been high in Senegal for a while. There's been riots all of last week because of constant power cuts and things like that. So it's not just because of the football.
All right. Now, Senegal then won't be going to the World Cup. Gambia, Uganda, DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola also not going. Ghana just scraped through in the end. You've got, who else? A lot of the big names like Ivory Coast, etc. Togo, who are through to the second stage, which will determine who actually makes it. How many African teams in the end will make it from that 20?
Four? I think there'll be six, including six? South Africa, who are obviously there as
right,
hosts.
Okay. Togo, let's just quickly mention them, because they had a huge win, 6-0 over Swaziland, which featured four goals from Emmanuel Adebayor in his first game since the famous occasion when he refused to get on the team plane unless the head of the Togo FA was flying on it, because he didn't trust their arrangements and the kind of safety record of the plane, yeah?
Yeah. In fairness to Adebayor, he's not a diva. He a lot of pressure is put on him to represent the players because he's the one guy who can afford to be dropped or fined or whatever. Mm. So he has become the spokesman for the players, and they always get him to make these kind of threats, etc., on their behalf. But, good win. He scored four, and Swaziland actually beat them in the previous encounter in Swaziland. So it was a good win.
Yeah, certainly was. Is that a quite a common issue? The FA people flying on proper planes and the players, which with often fate were not often,
yeah.
In the past, in certainly more than one case, I think, fatal consequences for the players when their planes fall out of the sky.
Yeah, well, there was the famous when the Zambian team were all killed.
Yeah.
The officials, and it's not only in Africa, it has to be said, in Ireland, this is Roy Keane famously complained about it. The officials treat themselves better than they tend to treat the players.
There you go, then. There you go.
Can I just clear that six teams from Africa are going to the World Cup?
Hmm. You want to talk about Group 2
of the
European?
Well, just at that point, Group 2. Two teams from...
European Group 2.
Yeah, European Group 2. Two teams from Greece, Israel, Switzerland, Latvia, Luxembourg and Moldova are guaranteed to go to the World Cup.
No, that's not true.
No,
one
is guaranteed and one gets into the
playoff. One team's guaranteed.
Oh, right. Well,
it's one too many, though.
Well, yeah, quite.
Hmm. There you go. You could get rid of Group 2, you reckon, Barney?
Absolutely. Just get rid of it. Who's going to miss them?
Well, the Greeks and the Israelis might have something to say about that.
Quite.
Hmm. That really does bring us to the end of today's podcast. So, Barney Roney, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Raphael, cheers.
Thank you.
Paul Doyle, outstanding stuff.
Thanks.
Thanks, producer Pete. Thank you, listeners. We're back on Thursday with a full roundup of the midweek action and a look forward to the return of club football this weekend. See you then.